This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The US House of Representatives has passed its version of the American Health Care Act. Now, the Senate has to come up with its version of the act, which would repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. A group of Republican senators have been working on the bill behind closed doors, drawing criticism from Democrats and Republicans alike. Republican Congressman Daniel Webster says it's not how he would like to see the bill get passed.
Well, I mean, I'm for open process. I've always been that way. That's why I challenged Speaker Boehner when he was Speaker of the House and so forth. It's because I want to have an open process. But what the Senate does, they do a lot of strange things. And I don't govern any of that. You know, the idea of a 40% being able to stop a piece of legislation or an appointee or something like that is ridiculous. We are a country that lives on a majority. That's the way it works. But that's not me. I'm not in the Senate.
I spoke to Webster, who represents Florida's 11th Congressional District, after he'd just given a speech at a Flag Day event in Tiveres. Webster and his fellow lawmakers are still rattled by the shooting at a Republican baseball practice last week that left House Whip Steve Scalise in critical condition.
Well, I think the mood is somewhat in shock, but the other is I think that members are very grateful that things turned out the way they did. But I think lastly, I think the thought is just on the fact that what could have happened, and it could have happened. I mean, I know how it all came down. I have a picture in my mind of it, and I know that it could have been a catastrophe, could have been a mass assassination.
And even now, Steve Scalise is still in pretty bad shape, right?
He is. He was hit in the hip. There's a... Brad Winstrom, representative from Illinois, is a medical doctor. He was in the military, medical doctor. He was a battlefield doctor. He's the first one that got to him and understood what needed to be done. In his words, he said that, there are things that happen, but the first thing is to stop the bleeding. And I think that's what they did, the first surgery, and now they got to tend to everything else, which I know nothing about.
Congressman, given your speech just now for Flag Day, you were getting a little bit emotional recounting that story from back in the 70s. Is that kind of reflecting on what's just happened up in D.C. this week or sort of thinking back to that event back in the 70s?
I think I was only thinking to the flag. I wasn't necessarily thinking, what Craig Mundy did was heroic, but it wasn't anything like what happened in D.C. The D.C. event was just a picture of the fact that there were heroes. In the beginning, they're heroes today, and the lady who was the driver for Steve Scalise, after being wounded, was able to take down that shooter, was nothing short of a miracle.
So we saw some bipartisanship, evidently, in the game that followed the charity baseball game, and just even on Capitol Hill, some unified calls for, a return to, civility. Do you see that bipartisanship, that spirit of bipartisanship, continuing into lawmaking, or is it just a temporary pause?
I think civility and agreeing on issues are two different things. You can disagree and be nasty about it, or you can be disagree and be civil about it. And I think that's what people are hoping for. It's not like somebody's going to change their philosophy because of that, except for the fact the way things are presented and the way things are discussed. Hopefully they can be within a civil matter, a civil situation, as opposed to nasty talking all the time, and because it stirs people up and it just needs to stop.
So talking about one of the big issues right now on Capitol Hill, of course, the American Health Care Act, the attempt to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. What's the latest on that?
Well, we have cleared the Senate. We have cleared the House, the American Health Care Act, and went to the Senate. The Senate had to clear the provisions of that. There's a provision called reconciliation. We can use it once a year. It only takes 51 votes to secure a victory in the Senate on that. Everything else has that 60-vote threshold for closure of debate and so forth. That doesn't take place under reconciliation, but it only happens once a year. It has to save money, and that's decided by the parliamentarian of the Senate. That now has they have cleared all the provisions of that bill as okay under the Byrd rule, which is what governs reconciliation. So it's kind of like down in the weeds, but all of that had to take place before the Senate actually got to moving it. Now they're ready. I think I heard the Senate leader say that I think here just in a few short weeks they're going to be able to vote on that bill.
there's a balancing act, right, between saving money, which is obviously important, and making sure that people still get the health care they need. Are you confident that the bill that, you know, went through the House and then now through the Senate is the one, the right bill?
I think it is. I think there, but I don't think that's what the Senate's going to necessarily approve. I think they've got some ideas too, and we'll see what happens there. But I believe that it is a good balance. Something has to happen. Obamacare is broken. It's in a death spiral. Most of the insurance companies have said we're bailing because we can't do it.
Some of them though are actually saying they want to bring on more customers. That is happening too.
They would like to do that, but it just hasn't happened. Even this year when they were talking about 12 million people that were going to be signed up, it's only 10. And so 2 million more dropped out. The reason they drop out is because they don't fully understand deductibles and the fact that that's an expensive part of the policy. Other places, there are like 5 million people in the country that have no place to buy insurance as an individual purchaser. They pulled out of counties. About two-thirds of the states, there are counties that there's only one or two providers, so there's really not any competition. And I think that's what we're trying to bolster the market, bring it back so there's many, many competitors, and lower costs, hopefully fulfill what was promised by the Obamacare that didn't happen. You could keep your doctor. Our policy allows you to keep your doctor. Saves the $2,500 that they were talking about saving, which actually have increased over 100% nationally, the cost of health care. That's a lot of money. And then thirdly, you could keep your policy, and that was not happening under Obamacare. So the promises, the underpinning promises of Obamacare failed, and so we tried to bolster them back up.
What about pre-existing conditions? Where is that in the American Health Care Act?
It is, we have universal coverage. You cannot be denied coverage, no matter what. So that's covered. And same with 26-year-old, up to 26 years old can be under their parents' plan, and you cannot be dropped. There's no ultimate limit in the policy, a lifetime limit. Most of those things are still in there. Those are the popular ideas that people like to have. But as far as...
And those were in the Affordable Care Act, right? So there are some things about it that people liked.
Yes. But those were kind of policy, not too expensive in most cases. But the problem was, if they're not going to offer it, or if it's going to be so expensive you can't buy it, that creates a problem. We're also allowing states to create their own plan and be able to, under Medicaid, be able to get a block grant and run their own plan and probably cover a lot more people.
Okay, so what about the idea of people losing insurance under the American Health Care Act, rather? I mean, there have been numbers floating around. Millions and millions of people losing what they had under the Affordable Care Act. I mean, is that something that your constituents tell you about and say they're worried about? Would this change, potential change in the way healthcare is delivered here in the United States?
It doesn't mean that everyone can be covered. The problem here is the thing: if you force people to do it, then they're going to have to sign up, or they're going to have to pay a penalty. We took away the two mandates, for a corporate mandate and so there are a group of people that won't. The number that's thrown around is for 2027, I believe, and it was assuming that these people would sign up being forced, because the penalty goes up each year, eventually they'll do it. So if you make people buy broccoli, they do. If you don't force them to, some won't, and that's where it is. So it's not like they don't have coverage, it's they choose not to have coverage.
But if they choose not to, then that creates a knock-on effect of problems with hospitals having to provide emergency care and not being reimbursed for it. So, I mean, comparing healthcare to broccoli, I see what you're getting at here, Congressman, but, I mean, if people aren't being compelled to buy it and they aren't buying insurance, doesn't that create problems down the track?
I'm just saying anything you force people to buy, and if they don't buy it, you're going to be penalized, is going to make more people buy it, probably. We're thinking lower cost, more competition, better insurance, lower deductibles is what's going to make people want to participate. So the mandates have always been a question. There has always been a question of should the federal government come in and mandate things, including any type of thing, including buying health care insurance. And if so, that take that away, maybe there'll be people that won't. But in the end, I think if we make it affordable, they will.
So what are you hearing from your constituents about healthcare? What are they telling you when you come to events like this and you hear from folks in your district?
I think people would like to have more competition. I think they would like to have a lower price and lower deductibles. That's what we've been working on.
And I want to just come back to the point we're talking about at the very start of the conversation, concerns about security and, Congress people being deliberately targeted. Does it make you rethink holding town halls or coming to public events yourself, Congressman Webster?
It probably makes me more aware. I want to make sure that takes place. And I think that the Capitol Police are coming up with guidelines and so forth to make sure that those things are governed and controlled locally. But still, they're going to engage themselves more in that. So I just think you've got to be more aware. That's what I'm going to be, more aware. If somebody just shows up at a ballpark at a fun event and decides to start mowing people down and got some weapons to do so, you got to think that, hey, you got to be more careful.
Congressman Daniel Webster, thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Appreciate it.
Still to come.
Greens and peas and okra and tomato, that's sort of what we grew up on, so that'll keep them out of the fast food restaurants and they'll eat more healthy.
A community garden that's supplying organic veggies for residents in the historic black town of Eatonville. Intersections back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A couple blocks from the main road in Eatonville, Lester Cunningham is hosting a monthly meet-up for the Eatonville Yard and Garden Club. Food is laid out on tables in front of the house, and in the big plot next to the house is a flourishing vegetable garden.
We had the garden club, and we were looking for places to do the garden. We have five different locations that we use.
So you got like a veggie empire going on here.
Right, yes.
When did you start the gardening club?
About 5 years ago. Shepherd and myself, we had a garden, and then others wanted to see it, and then they see all the greeneries we have and the plants and the flowers and the mangoes and, I got pears and, so after they see that and it stayed green all the time, and then different ones wanted ideas and had questions about gardening and how you keep it year-round.
What got you started in gardening? Is this something you've been doing all your life?
Well, my grandparents had always had a garden. I never did do a garden until after I retired. After I retired, then I started gardening.
And how long ago was that?
10 years ago.
So once a month you have a get-together and you invite people and share the food from the garden?
Right. Once a month we try to give back to the community. It's all natural. We try to use something from the garden, greens or cabbage or, the chicken is not from the garden, but the vegetables usually come from the garden.
You've got a pretty good crowd here. Are you kind of surprised by the popularity of this and how it's snowballed into something more than just a garden in your own backyard?
No, because when you feed, usually people going to come. And a lot of people come and help us or pull weeds. And then so we give back to them by inviting them when we have our meeting. So all of the work is not done between Shepherd and I. We have community help to help us. So then we feed whoever come.
So what's next for this this project? Do you want to plant more gardens? Do you want to expand this one?
Our goal is to try to start producing on a larger scale for the community and have a farmer's market in Eatonville. And that way we can feed people healthy, natural and organic.
Well, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Right now, the gardens are run on a shoestring budget by Cunningham and Master Gardener Ruford Shepherd. The club got some seed money from the Florida Department of Agriculture to get things started. Now they're looking for more funding for things like staff to weed the garden, irrigation, and someone who can harvest the produce. The estimated cost of all of this is about $40,000 a year. Ruford Shepherd takes me on a tour of the garden.
My name is Ruford Shepherd. I'm the master grower for the PEC to preserve the Eatonville community. And I'm a landscaper, and I also do tree arboring and everything else up under that there. I've been doing this here for about 41 years, gardening and indoor foliage, which is tropical foliage. Now I come out to woody ornamental foliage and got burnt out. So I just went into landscaping and gardening.
This is a really lush expanse of veggie garden you've got here. It's what, about an acre?
Right, this here's an acre we got. It's right at an acre we got up under production. Mm-hmm. We got as much as we want back there, but the gardens need quite a bit of sunlight. So here is where we start our first gardens off and some of the plants that we have in it. It's okra, it's peas, it's beans, it's squash, it's cucumber, watermelon. We got a lot of sweet potato, and that's what we have here at this time. This is our mid-spring garden. We also do a garden for the fall with the festival, so right. We could kind of have stuff from the garden that could be presented at the festival and all. We just got, this is our second year crop here. We just got this spot of land, but it's beautiful. We brought in about 22 yards of organic compost. We use no pesticides, no herbicides, no fungicides, no anything here, but just organic fertilizer. And if we get an insect problem here, like here, what we do, we get everybody in town's charcoal ash, and we throw the ash over it, and it's sort of like seven dust. It'll deter most bugs.
And so you've had a few insects here, but you just tossed a bunch of ash on it?
We just threw ashes on it, and it pretty much stopped them here. Mm-hmm. If I have any worse of trouble, I'm just going to go in with me some soap and water, mm-hmm. just to kind of, you know, just get the mold and take it off and do it that way. We had a bad break with our corn. Most cutworms got in the corn because of the rain. But in season now, we do is okra, it's peas, it's butter beans, it's field peas, it's string beans, it's pole beans, and then we got watermelons, they're not quite ripe yet. We got cucumbers, we got sweet potatoes that's coming off shortly.
It's been a pretty dry spring, and then all of a sudden we got like a few weeks of solid rain. What did that do to your crops here?
That monsoon really turned everything crazy. It helped us in one way of not paying for irrigation, but it hurt us most so in the tomatoes. Everything, the tomatoes, water, they sucks it up, and it goes straight in the tomato, and they busts. The collard greens, the same thing. We it's time we have to just replant collard greens in another 2 months because it just, you know, sucked it up and just rotting all of the collard greens. And then besides that there, it just saturates everything. But the okra and the beans, they could stand it. They love it. So it's six in one hand, half a dozen in the other. We're about really still balanced out with what we planted, not knowing or not expecting the rain.
So have you harvested all your okra so far? You still
No, we are just starting to harvest okra. It's 2 days I've been here. You could see the baby ones there. Mm-hmm. Let me just, they itch so bad. Let me just show you what, we can walk down the side here and give you a good idea. Here we go. See here?
Oh, yeah.
That'll be A1. And that'll be A1.
See, now, when you say A1, what do you mean by that?
The way they do okra and apples, and when they are youngest at their peak, they call them A1s. Then it's a number 2. And then when they're long, they're number 3. They're for pickling and all. Here's for anything. Mm-hmm. You know, okra, fried okra, stewed okra, number 1.
This is going to be the sweetest, tenderest okra.
Exactly, exactly. That's what it is, the sweetest and the tenderest.
Now, what happens to all this produce? Because you're going to generate a lot of food out of this acre of land here.
What we did with the yards and garden, it was a pilot program for the town. Anybody in town can come in, get what they want, leave a small donation, and leave. If not, just get what they want. When that there seems to go bad, that's what we are doing now with Rollins College. We're hooking up with someone that could take it away from us, and they'll sell it and get us a little payment from it so we don't just lose it all.
So is it just you in this garden, or you got some assistants?
No, I have assistants. Mr. Cunningham, then I have 2 more assistants, and we pay them $10 to $12 an hour, depending on what they know, to come in and help weed. And then when we get ready to turn it over, and we bring the compost in, and we bring it back in, we take all of this here out, and we feed it to a lot of, chickens and turkeys and goats. We got a little farm back there. We feed a lot of the, once we pull it up and stuff, like we got goats and chicken and animals back there, rabbits and...
How many of the folks in Eatonville take advantage of this, of these veggies here?
I think last year we may have had about 700.
That's quite a lot.
Yeah, we had quite a few of them come through, and they was consistent. You know, they kept coming back because greens and peas and okra and tomato, that's sort of what we grew up on, you know, so that'll keep them out of the fast food restaurants and they eat more healthy. We are working on what we're going to do here, but everything that we wanted to do for this program, it was successful.
Mm-hmm. And so what are you looking for now? Like, what's the next step for this garden?
The next step is we are getting somebody, once we grow it, we're getting somebody to take it and sell it at a different place. You know, I would like to see a store on the corner with nothing but organic plants, you know, and we serve them twice or three times a week. Or they take it and put it in the marketplace. I know places in Orlando like Star Market that I could probably sell everything I have here. And they'll profit it wrong. They'll profit it for what it is, organic, but when I sell it to them, I sell it to them at the lowest cost, and I just don't want you to make a 300% profit on them.
Right.
You know, so that's basically why we're trying to get one independent here. A guy out of Rollins College, he knows some guys that does that type of thing, and he got with us on our last annual meet, and he's getting back with us, and he's going to take it and put us in the right way, put us in the right line, supposedly.
Now, can you show me the little farm you got in the back of the garden?
Yes, sir. Some watermelons here. You see the, all those blooms? Mm-hmm. That's where your fruit comes.
Okay. And when do these guys mature?
We probably got another 36 days on those. We had quite a few of them had them fruited, but you see what the water doing to them also? Mm-hmm. You know, all succulent.
So it's a tricky balance with the weather.
Exactly. Exactly. We got turkeys. We got geese. We got chickens, we got turtles, we got bigger geese. But those, you see,
quite a lot of birds. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, are these birds for eating? Are they for laying eggs? What are they for?
Most of the time, for the laying eggs, and just for showing the kids. I got 18 ground bears at Hungerford Elementary School also that I maintenance and maintain. And I have kids hands-on, and they help grow them.
You've got another plot of land over at the elementary school?
The elementary school, it's Orange County's land, but I do the beds. They got 18 individual beds, 8 by 10. And I get the kids out of the classrooms, the elementary kids, and they hands-on. They wet the soil, they turn the soil, they plant them, and they watch it grow. And we try to get them hands-on to let them know what you got here in the farming. You know, that's where your chickens come from. And all these here chickens here is organic grown chickens. You know, the turkey, the geese, I mean, everything. When we got a supplier there in Mount Dora that supplies the birds when they're very small, and we raise them here with all of the vegetables and stuff, and they love it.
And then are these Thanksgiving turkeys? Are they going to end up on a Thanksgiving plate somewhere?
No, they're going to see, and that's a small turkey there. No, we just got them. And once they get too big, we'll just donate them to Green Acres Farm out there off of 192, I think it is. You know.
So these birds have a pretty sweet life.
Yeah, they're living their life. They get the fed, they get the three meals a day, then they get, you know, the water, and then they get the entertainment of kids coming in, rubbing them. You know, and we take them to the school if necessary.
That's Ruford Shepherd. He's the Master Gardener for the Association to Preserve Eatonville, feeding the birds at the historic Eatonville Yards and Gardens Club. Still to come, how do you pay the bills and buy groceries if you're one of the working poor?
Very few communities in the United States have a working poor rate of over 40%. We're the highest by far.
Most of the people in this community wouldn't be able to shop and get like fresh fruit, decent fruit, organic products to feed their families.
Every day, hundreds of people come to the Orlando nonprofit United Against Poverty's grocery store to buy essentials they couldn't otherwise afford. We visit the nonprofit's campus and talk to Executive Director Eric Gray about his approach to fighting poverty. You can find Intersection online, WMFE.org, or on the NPR One app. And you can download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. For families on the poverty line, there's a balancing act between paying rent and utilities, paying for medication, and putting food on the table. United Against Poverty provides an alternative to the food bank. The Orlando campus on West Michigan Street on the border of Holden Heights offers groceries at a fraction of what they'd cost at a regular grocery store. Near the produce section, Willie Bennett surveys the shop floor, a Bluetooth headset blinking in his ear. Bennett spends his days on the road picking up food from donors.
Various vendors, Publix, GFS, Del Mar, Fresh Market, Harville's, Roma, Goya, everywhere.
That's quite a list.
Yeah, a lot of places, man. I'm sure I'm forgetting many, many more. I know I'm forgetting many more.
How much time do you spend on the road driving around collecting food?
All day. Like, I'm on call right now. I just came back. It might call me right now. I go pick up 10 pallets from sunny Florida. And I go over there and get it, bring it back.
And how far away do you go to get the food? What's the radius?
70-80 miles. Yeah, sometimes I go to Tampa. They come from Tampa right there, Del Mar. The tomatoes and stuff, all over.
So you're never really going to know sort of week to week what you're necessarily going to have in the grocery store.
Exactly, exactly. Never know.
Does that make it challenging for the folks coming in here? Like, how do they know what they're going to get?
That's the beauty of it, because you always get little gems. Every time you come, you're going to find something that you've been looking for at a good price. You know what I'm saying? So it's good.
And you were saying you're from this community?
Yes, sir.
So what's the kind of interaction that people who shop here have with you and with the other folks volunteering here?
It's more personal. Mm-hmm. It's not like going to Walmart, because it's like you're separated. Here you're more into the client, the patron. So, you know, I know a lot of them, and it's more personalized, like family, an extended family.
And do some of them sort of come to you outside of working hours and say, what do you got coming up at the shop this week?
Sometimes when I pull up and they ask me, hold on 1 second. How much is the plantain? Okay, he can find out for you. Like sometimes when I pull up, they see me and they know I'm a driver, and they see me in different places. They're like, well, how much is this? How much is that? You know what I'm saying? What you got on the truck? So they always trying to see what we have in the store. Or do we have anything coming up that's special? Various things like that.
Do you enjoy working here?
I love it. I love it because you got to understand, like, most of the people in this community wouldn't be able to shop and get, like, fresh fruit, decent fruit, organic products to feed their families. Like, these people literally in here shopping to feed their families. This is not a joke. It may seem distant or out of the ordinary for a lot of people outside of this community, but this is a staple here in this community. We must have this. This has to go on. And then from the looks of things, we may need 10 more of these places. You know what I'm saying? Because of the economy, they really need this stuff. Like, you got all the organic stuff. The average person in this community can't afford organic milk, let alone a regular gallon of milk.
And this place has been here, what, 16 years?
Yes, most certainly. Yeah, yeah.
So what were people doing before that?
Man, catching hell, H.E. Devil hockey sticks, yeah, to survive.
Executive Director Eric Gray explains to join the grocery program, you have to be at 200% or below the federal poverty line. For a family of four, that's a household income of $48,600.
This adjusts every couple of years, but it's not a regular thing that adjusts all the time. It's really up to each individual administration, executive administration in the White House, to kind of talk about how they're going to influence the poverty rate. This has only been in existence since 1963. There's a woman named Molly Orshansky, who is in the Kennedy administration, was asked to develop a level that defines what poor means. And so she was from Eastern Europe and based it off of what she spent the most amount of money on in her family, which was the cost of milk. And so the federal poverty level has developed much more accurately over the years from the cost of a price of milk.
I've heard the Big Mac described as a economic indicator as well.
Sometimes people talk about that. I will say that the different departments that are engaged in that process, Health and Human Services, Housing, Urban Development, Department of Labor, they actually do a really good job of trying to indicate how much does it cost to live in the United States of America as a whole, which is really difficult when you think about it. It's going to be very different for somebody living in Topeka, Kansas, as opposed to Manhattan, you know, or Orlando. So
sure.
You do a good job with it, but there's only so much you can do. The average family of four with a household income of $48,500 would be kind of the typical family that we would see here. The unique thing about Orlando is not its poverty level. We have our poverty level is really on average on par with the rest of the United States, right around 15%. which is still way too high. But what's unique about Orlando is the rate of people at 200% of U.S. poverty. And the other term used to define that is called the working poor. So the rate of working poor households in Orange, Seminole, and Osceola County is about 44% of the community. Very few communities in the United States have a working poor rate of over 40%. We're the highest by far.
So essentially, the old adage that if you get a job, that's going to solve most of your problems doesn't really fit here.
Well, I think that the adage that a job is the solution to poverty, there's no question, because if poverty in this case is a measure of income and income comes from a job, then jobs are the solution. What's challenging about Orlando is that we have a lot of low-wage jobs. There's nothing wrong with those jobs. It just makes it difficult when the cost to live in the community doesn't really match up with the income in the community, one way or the other. So we get volunteer groups from all over the country that come in and work with us. This is a very unique program. It doesn't exist anywhere else in the United States. And so we get volunteer groups from as far away as Oregon. I think it's the farthest we've ever had. This is a group from North Carolina that's a church group, and they're traveling around. But they've been stocking shelves for the last 3 hours, and now they're wrapping up, and they're singing a song before they go home, so which is not uncommon. We've had marching bands in here and performance groups. We've had mimes. Most of the people that volunteer here just come in and volunteer and stock shelves, but every once in a while somebody will kind of add their own element to it, which is great. People don't do this at Publix, so it's a little different. Let me show you around the other side over here and talk a little bit about. So this is a slow day for us, and you can see
Your parking lot is packed.
It's packed, and what happens is that we have exploded in our membership over the last couple of years in ways that we did not anticipate happening. We partnered with a lot of other nonprofits, other faith organizations that send people to us in need because, frankly, the churches and the nonprofits and even government, they're outgunned in this community. And the reason they're outmatched and outgunned is because the enormity of the population of people in need. So we're not talking about a small portion of the population. You're talking about in a community of about 2.5 million people, half the community is earning $30,000 or less. And that's the only community in the United States where that's the case. 44% of the community, almost half, are considered the working poor. And that 200% of U.S. poverty. And a lot of people will blame that on tourism. And while certainly our tourism economy plays a part in that, of the 22 job categories that the Department of Labor measures, like agriculture or business, Orlando is the lowest individual wage community in 21 of those 22 categories. So it's every industry in the community, with the exception of manufacturing, where we're not the lowest. The problem with our manufacturing base is that only 4.1% of our jobs are manufacturing related, which is the smallest in the United States. And the reason that that's the case, in my opinion, is because we're the largest city in the United States, not on a navigable body of water. So there's no port. So over the last 160 years, no manufacturing base has grown up around that. So it's no one person's fault. You could blame it on the founders of the city 165 years ago, but they were just trying to improve the cattle crop that they had at the time, which led to citrus, which led to the land being more valuable for real estate and tourism and so on. So we've been doing the best we can, and I think Orlando is a miracle story in some ways that we survive at all, and because there's no natural resource here. Our resource is the land itself, but we don't grow anything in this defined metropolitan community anymore. There's still citrus, there's still crops, but not as a major portion of our economy overall.
Right, and the citrus crops you see are dwindling pretty fast.
Very fast, because the citrus owners determined, just like in decades before them, that the cattle owners realized that the land is more valuable to sell for development. The problem in Orlando is that when you have this many people who need additional support, people that are full-time working but cannot afford everyday items that that are really necessity. We're talking about utilities, housing, food, medicine. I'm not talking about frivolous things here. They're having a hard time making ends meet just to find transportation to and from their jobs. So what we're struggling with economically is that a community whose economic base at its core is eroding because its own population can't support itself means it can't support new business either. And so we don't have as many new businesses moving to the area because there's no market for them to sell to except for the tourism market, for the 68 million people a year who come here, which is significant, you know, and that works out to be tens of thousands of people a day. But at the end of the day, if you're going to move a business here, you have to have the labor force because you're marketing the product to outside communities, or you have to have the buying force because you're selling products within that community.
How does that fit into the narrative, Eric Gray, of trying to encourage more businesses to move to the state as a whole and to Central Florida specifically?
Well, I think, you know, with Governor Scott's initiative is very well intended since he was elected almost 8 years ago now to bring more jobs to the community. I appreciate that, and I think that's important. What has happened on some occasions is that we have found ourselves marketing Florida as an opportunity for businesses to move here for the low wage opportunities, meaning they don't have to pay their employees as much.
Not every business, though, right? I mean, there is also a push for high-tech, high-paid jobs.
There absolutely is. And a lot of our leaders have really understood that for a very, very long time. But there have actually been initiatives organized by the state where they've actually said publicly, come to Florida, you know, you can pay lower wages to your staff here. And that's the kind of thing you do in Bangladesh or in Mexico City or somewhere else. That's not what at least I as a Floridian would hope, you know, is the selling point for the community. And I don't think anybody wants at the end of the day to pay people lower wages. I don't think anybody's looking to make anybody's lives difficult. I just think that it's become somewhat of the norm. So now the three lowest household income cities in the United States are all in Florida, Tampa, Miami, and Orlando, in terms of overall household income. And that's a bad place to be. And so that's why these programs exist, not because we're brilliant and we have this great nonprofit idea and we're helping a lot of people. It's because there's a lot of people that need help. If there weren't all these people, this particular organization, there would be no need for it and it wouldn't survive. The only reason we survive is because of the scale of the problem.
So we're out of the parking lot now. We're back inside the grocery store part of this campus. Just explain what we're looking at here. What do we see in front of us?
So we're looking at the cash registers. We've got four registers, two of them are open right now, and we're at a kind of a slower time of our day. There's four people in line, and they are coming past our freezers and coolers where we have frozen meats and other proteins and cheeses, and we're able to store and freeze goods for a long period of time. But we also get things that from the grocery programs that donate to us that aren't necessarily food. I can see up there I think that's a little safe, if I can even tell from here. There's little items, sunglasses, there's lawn equipment, there's weed spray. There's, you know, we have a lot of things. And what I think some people will come in here and say, you know, wow, do you really need to have, you know, candy or cookies in this type of program? And what I would say to them is, you know, well, that's what you buy when you go to the grocery store. And what I think really tends to surprise people is if they stand in here long enough volunteering, I guarantee you run into somebody you know. Because right now, of that 44% of the community that would qualify to use this program, of the entire Central Florida region, 7% of them are members here actively. So we're serving, you know, tens of thousands of people, and you know these people. This isn't somebody else. This is your neighbors, your friends, people that you work with. UCF did a study with us last year out of their sociology department, and when they interviewed over 800 of our members over a year, 72% of them have full-time jobs, 8% of them have part-time jobs, another 8% are seniors on a fixed income, no longer working. Another 8% are disabled and can't work. And the final 8% were destitute, homeless, with no income and no housing. But 72% are working full-time.
How many of those people have more than one job?
Well, the study didn't show that, but I can tell you just from personal experience, a lot of people who use this program have multiple part-time jobs. And part of the reason for that is the distinction over the last couple of years where employers have to pay health care benefits if the employee is working more than 30 hours a week. So you have a lot of employers who they max out your time at 25 to 29 hours. And so people might be working two part-time jobs adding up to 55 to 60 hours a week, but they're struggling because they don't have health care benefits. And while many would qualify for the Affordable Care Act or even possibly for Medicaid, depending on their income level, there's still a huge percentage of the population that doesn't qualify for any type of medical care. And so they end up in the emergency rooms at Florida Hospital and Orlando Health, which creates its own set of problems for the community in the long run, too. We right now house 28 other nonprofit organizations that do some work on this property at least weekly. And so we, at our core, are a very collaborative organization by trying to provide space for others that are trying to meet the same needs for the working poor. The unique nature of this program is that people are coming to us. And so agencies that might have to traditionally go out to seek and help people, say, like a Zebra Coalition, which is working specifically on LGBT youth, the Homeless Services Network, which is really trying to help get families and individuals into housing, they come set up here because the people that they want to serve are here. And so they can, Homeless Services Network, for example, comes out here once a week, and they specifically come once a week just to talk to families who are living in their cars. And their focus on that day is to how can we get you out of your car and into some type of regular housing. And so the unintended consequence of this organization, which is positive but never really intended, was that we become the housing and medical care and employment and disabled services hub for a lot of organizations, simply because we're the busiest social service agency in the state, and with 500 people a day coming into the doors, you might as well take advantage of the fact that the people who are coming here don't just have budgetary needs. They have a lot of other needs going on as well. So we can't address all of those as a nonprofit. We can focus on a few things, but the other 28 of our partners, they were able to make the process much easier for people. And nothing here is given away. That's really the core philosophy of the organization, that everything is a two-way giving process where the family that's in need, or the family benefiting from the services, has to offer up something.
And what is that?
So in the case of the grocery, it's actually money. You're actually, instead of at a traditional food pantry where you're going and getting a handout of a box of food from a church once every month on the second Tuesday of the month, here you can come as often as you want. You actually go through the process just like you were shopping. We don't call it a store, we call it a program. And we don't call them prices, we call them handling fees. But the idea here is to provide a dignified experience for people, and that they can find room in their budget for other things that are more important. So we're able to save families about 67 cents on the dollar in terms of their food. We don't have everything you would ever need here. We have produce, but I don't always have a full complement of produce. Like, I don't have apples today. You know, so if you're coming here looking for any type of produce like you would at Publix or Winn-Dixie, you're not going to find it. But the members here know that. And what we're trying to do is have them engage in the process. At food banks, the food is sold to the churches and to the community centers for them to operate. We go direct to the low-income families. One of the distinctions here is that we're able to verify that the families are low income. So at the membership desk I was showing you earlier, those applications have a verification process. When you bring in documentation of your income, we give you an upgraded card, and you get another 5% off at the register every time you use the program. And that right now, 71% of our members are income verified, which is really great, because I can say to our food donors that the people you are serving are the people you ought to serve. And that's not to say that people going to church food pantries don't need the help. But an emergency food pantry stops being an emergency after it's being used for multiple years or multiple generations in some cases.
But doesn't that just tell you something about the level of need there is in a community?
I think that it tells you something about the response that is required for the level of need in the community, meaning just being upset about the problem and identifying the problem is important, but how to react to it is also very important. Because if you are trying to teach a man to fish and then just throwing free fish in the pond constantly, or throwing free fish in his basket constantly, then and everybody in the community is doing that, the community doesn't get better. It doesn't get healthier over time. And this has been proven time and time again by sociologists all over the United States for the last 50 years, that the programs in communities where they are seeing positive trends are ones where they're engaging the population. They're working on things like the microloans, as an example, which is done in Africa and other countries. But other continents around the planet. It's not done as much in the United States, but in the communities where it has been done, in Appalachia, some lower-income communities in New Mexico, it's had great impact. So when you engage the community one-on-one, you're going to have a much greater success rate as a community overall than if you're just saying, okay, we've got a problem, so we're going to throw food at the problem and hope that people kind of figure it out for themselves. Some people will, but most will not.
You know, the picture you're painting, Eric Gray, seems pretty dire. This organization's been here for 16 years. From talking to you, from talking to Willie, it sounds like it's not really improving. So what does the future look like for this organization and just for the general picture of poverty and its attendant problems here in Central Florida?
Well, it is dire, and I wish I could say that we're moving the needle on poverty. I think the best we can say right now is that we're helping a lot of people and that we're moving the needle on the discussion. That's about the best I could say. And our board of directors, it's been now about 3 years ago, had this same question that you just posed. You know, how are we helping to end the problem, not just mitigate the problem? And their challenge to us was, we need you to figure out how to end poverty. And there was a real challenge. You know, they said, come up with a way, present it to us, we'll figure out how to fund it. And so we did it, but it's one family at a time. And so our calculus was that if poverty is looked at as just a measure of income, and income is measured by the jobs that you have, that we need to get people into better, higher-paying jobs. So we're working with people who typically have zero income, they're completely destitute, many of them are homeless and on the streets, and work with them in a long-term program to get them to not only out of poverty, but above 200% of U.S. poverty into self-sufficiency. And it's not as the numbers aren't as impressive. You know, we'll see 23,000 unique families in the grocery program this year, and I'll see about 200 unique families through my adult education program. But for those 200 people, it's no longer going to be possible for them to use the grocery program because they no longer qualify. So we're trying to put ourselves out of business, even if it's only a couple of dozen people at a time. But that's the new charge for the organization, is to empower and inspire families to lift themselves out of poverty. And we're just there to kind of guide them along the path as best we can. So we're not giving away money. What we're trying to do is get them into jobs and help them to sustain those jobs, because we're working with them not only on their physical stability, but their emotional stability. Because many people are coming out of really significant crises, domestic abuse, substance abuse, even the idea of and the actual action of being homeless can be incredibly debilitating mentally to someone. People just lose self-esteem, self-confidence. They get to a place where they don't believe they have any value. And so we are spending time with people who are in the worst of the worst type of situations, helping to rebuild their lives. And they really do it for one another. There's no specific sort of principle dictum that we follow. It's the idea here is we're just trying to get people to build their own self-confidence, stop for a moment, take some time to think, what's next for me? I have value, and I can plan out something that I know, if with a little bit of help and somebody coaching me along the way — that's literally one of our positions, it's called a success coach. And really, they're a case manager in the social services world. But we call it success coach because that's what we're trying. We're trying to coach people along to continue along the path that they started. It is really hard, but it's better than nothing. And we are literally ending poverty. It's just for a few people at a time.
That was Eric Gray, Executive Director of United Against Poverty Orlando. We spoke to him at the nonprofit's downtown Orlando campus. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The show's executive producer is Catherine Welch. If you missed an episode, you can download the podcast from iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. You can also find us over on the NPR One app, and you can follow me on Twitter @Matthew_Petty. Thanks for listening.